how can we understand Jesus in the framework of Judaism? I can think of no other study that we could take that would better illustrate this than this study on the Mishnah of Mark. Remember that the Mishnah was the first level of rabbinic interpretation, one that dealt in the grammatic level of interpretation. It was based on the seven laws of Rabbi Hillel, and it produced the Mishnah. The Mishnah is the simple level to simple people. And in our study today, we're going to see how the Mishnah of Mark, because Mark was a simple man writing to simple men, and we saw previously why Mark is parallel to the Mishnah. So today we want to take a particular aspect of Mark, and that is the story of the Talit and the Tzitzit of Jesus. And in our study, we'll be referring both to the book of Mark, chapter 5, and to the book of Numbers, chapter 15. Because in these two passages, we find the statement in the New Testament text, but without the understanding of the Old Testament or the Jewish scriptures, it is impossible to understand the full meaning of what the text themselves contain. In the book of Mark, chapter 5, very briefly, we find that Jesus had been at the south end of the Sea of Galilee at Gadara. The tribe of Gad bordered where the Jordan River ran out of the Sea of Galilee. And right there, where we find the bridge today, is the ancient town of Yara. Later it was called Gadara on the corner border of Israel. And in the tombs of Gadara, there was a man who had an evil spirit. And we see that in the first 20 verses of that chapter, Jesus healed the maniac of Gadara. And then in verses 21 and following, we find two miracles that involve Jesus' garment. First is the story of the woman who had an issue of blood, and then the raising of the daughter of Jairus. Now, in these two illustrating stories, we see a very dramatic picture of the use of the talit and the tzitzit. And our basic study today will be on the talit and the tzitzit, or the robe that Jesus wore. Many of you are familiar or have seen pictures of the Orthodox Jews praying with their prayer shawl. Now that prayer shawl is called a talit. You spell that T-A-L-I-T, talit. And the fringes on the border of that garment are called tzitzit, T-Z-I-T-Z-I-T, tzitzit. Now, for the background of our study today, if we follow rabbinic pattern, you always go to the Torah, to the Pentateuch, to the five books of Moses, and find the foundation and the basis of what it's talking about. Then you take a progressive historical study through the Haftorahs, or the prophets, and the writings, the Psalms, and so forth, and then come into the New Testament and correlate what you see here at relative to what you saw historically. We must understand the historical background and begin with the foundation of the Torah that was spoken by God to Moses on Mount Sinai. Here in verse 37 of the book of Numbers, chapter 15, "And the Lord spake unto Moses, saying, Speak unto the children of Israel." Remember, before we have pointed out that everything in the Bible is written to someone. All the Bible is not written to me, but it's all written for me. So what we're studying today is not to us, it's to Israel. But it is for us, because unless we understand what is written for us, we will never understand what's written to us. And every paragraph in the Bible begins, in the law, began with the words, Ve Omer Adonai LeMoshe, Deber B'nei Yisrael. And the Lord spake unto Moses, saying, speak unto the children of Israel and say so and so. So all the Bible was written, first of all and primarily addressed in the Torah to Israel. Now, let us look at just a moment. In the following verses we read that Moses was commanded to speak to the children of Israel and bid them that they make fringes in the borders of their garments throughout their generations. And that they put upon the fringe of the borders of their garment a ribbon of blue. And it shall be unto you for a fringe, that ye may look upon it and remember all the commandments of the Lord to do them, and that ye seek not after your own heart and your own eyes, after which you used to go whoring, that ye may remember to do all my commandments, to be holy to your God. I am the Lord your God, which brought you out of the land of Egypt to be your God. I am the Lord your God. Here, in closing, the reading of the Torah and the commandment given to his people Israel, that throughout their generations forever, they should lay on their shoulders a garment, a tallit, with four corners, and that four-cornered garment would have fringes, and those fringes would be for a certain purpose. Now, first of all, I would like for us to see what does this mean. What is the meaning of this tallit? The word tallit itself has a very interesting derivative. We find that the word tal, spelt with a tet lamed in Hebrew, the same in Arabic and in Persian for that matter, the word tal means a covering or a tent, but a special kind of tent. The word tal is also used for the covering of dew over the ground. Little driplets of water is tal. And so it is with the little tent, the tallit. The tallit actually means a little pup tent, a little individual tent. So each tallit represents an individual tent for each individual Jew. But what is the meaning of the tallit? We find that in the book of Numbers, a little later than our text is taken, we find that Balaam, in the 24th chapter of Numbers, Balaam, attempting to curse Israel, could not help but bless them. And he said, "How goodly are thy tents, O Jacob," in verse 5 of Numbers 24, "and thy tabernacles, O Israel. The valleys are spread forth as the gardens by the river side, as the trees of lime aloes which the Lord hath planted, and the cedars beside the waters." Now notice here, he says, "How goodly are thy tents, O Jacob, and thy dwelling, O Israel." The dwelling, the tabernacle, is one thing. The dwelling, or the tabernacle of Israel, the Mishkan, was the big sanctuary built by Moses and Bezaleel in the essence of the sanctuary and the holy place. That is the tabernacle of the Lord. And this is where God dwelt in the midst of his people. But every Jew, every man of every house, stood in his own little tent. You see, there was not room in the tabernacle for anyone except the priest. And in the big tent, the Mishkan, God met with his people. But there were five overlays or coverings for the tabernacle itself. The first tabernacle, the first covering that went over the sanctuary, was of white linen. The final one, which overhung all the other hangings, was blue linen, or was blue skins, excuse me. It was blue skins. And when the priest went under the white linen tent, off to the wings on each side, on the north and the south, he could see the borders of blue overhanging the white. This is the picture of the tabernacle. And on each corner were guy ropes, and along the north and south side were tent ropes holding the tent up of the tabernacle of the congregation. And when the priest entered into the sanctuary in the morning and the evening oblation, every Jewish man would get outside his tent. And there he would drape himself in his tallit, and as the priest went into the tabernacle, he would pull his little tent over himself. And like the big tent, out at the borders were the ribbons of blue, and on each corner were the guy ropes, called the tzitzit, in this miniature little tent, where each individual Jew was identified on the outside of the tabernacle with what was going on the inside of the tabernacle. Now, there's an illustration here I would like to draw for the Christian's benefit. And that is that when it says the order of the host, the extent of the tents of Moses could not exceed the width of the tabernacle. In other words, when they came to the north and when they came into the across the east and west to where the north and south wall of the sanctuary came down, they did not cast their tents any wider than the tabernacle was wide. And then behind Moses' tents were Aaron's, and behind Aaron's the house of Levi, and behind that the tribe of Judah, and so on. So that on the back side, on the front side toward the east, there were the three largest tribes of Israel encamped on the east side of the tabernacle of the congregation. On the west side, westward, were the three smallest tribes of the children of Israel. And the number of the children of Israel, according to the book of Numbers, were about three times as many on the east side as there was on the west, so that put the tabernacle of the congregation two-thirds way up the column. Then the other six tribes of Israel encamped, three on the north side and three on the south side, forming their rows of tents no longer than the tabernacle was long. So when Balaam looked down and saw the tents of Israel, and he attempted to curse them, and he blessed them, and he said, "How goodly are thy tents, O Jacob, and thy dwelling, O Israel." In his attempt to curse Israel, he blessed it, but I think that this Gentile prophet saw something that Israel themselves could not see. Because in the ninth verse of the preceding chapter, he said, "From the top of the rocks I see him, from the hills I behold him. Lo, the people shall dwell alone and not be reckoned among the nations. Who can count the dust of Jacob or number the fourth part of Israel? Let me die the death of the righteous, and let my last end be like his." Now here there is somewhat of an eschatological view that Balaam gets of Israel. Somehow this Gentile prophet looks down and he sees what Israel cannot see. In the profile of the tabernacle of the congregation, with that long column of tents, and two-thirds of the way up stands the tabernacle of the congregation. And then the east and west, the shorter columns of the other six tribes of Israel stretched out. There was a profile of the cross. But you say, well, why can't the Jews see that? Because they are not supposed to see that. You see, they're down there making a part of it. And without their making a part of it, there would be nothing for Balaam to see. Oh, that the Christian could understand that God has, as Paul said, and I don't say that in a condemning way, but judicially blinded Israel. Not in darkness, but in all the light that they had, God judicially blinded them so they could not see what the Gentile sees. Israel, down in the columns and in the lines of the tents, could not see what Balaam could see from the top of the rocks. Can you see that? The blindness was not one of stupidity, or it was not one of ignorance. They were down there making the picture. So in the act of making the picture of the profile of the cross, they could not see that profile. And it's so tragic today that the Christian cannot see that simple truth in Romans, the 11th chapter, where he says, as concerning the gospel, they are alienated, but as concerning the election, they are beloved for the patriarch's sake. You see, they are a part of it. And that's the reason they do not have the same perception as we as Christians. But let us go on. Now, when Balaam looked down and said, "How goodly are thy tents, O Jacob, and thy dwelling, O Israel," what he was seeing was actually these Jewish men, the fathers, the elders of Israel, out in front of their tents, and as the high priest went in, they were shaking before the Lord, and the entire congregation, the tents, the linen, tallits of Israel were glistening in the sun as the sacrifice of the morning oblation went up. "How goodly are thy tents, O Jacob, and thy tabernacle, O Israel." And I can see him, but not now. I can behold him, but not soon, literally. We see the beautiful picture here of what Balaam the prophet saw. We could spend much time on this, but we must go on. And in the drama of this story, we see that the tabernacle, the Mishkan, speaks of the dwelling place of God, and that Israel is inside his own little tent. Each Israelite has on his little tent that identifies him with what's going on in the big tent. Many centuries ago, the tabernacle was buried under the temple when Solomon built the temple. The quarry of the temple became the sepulcher of the tabernacle. And then Jeremiah the prophet hid the tabernacle in 2 Maccabees chapter 2, verses 1 through 6 in Mount Nebo, which would be returned in the last days when Israel brought their people again. Then there was the temple during the first temple period, the second temple period. But now, almost 2,000 years later, there has been no earthly temple. But every Orthodox Jew in the world, when he puts on the tallit, he remembers the tabernacle of the Lord. He remembers the house of God. He remembers the holy temple. And not only does he remember it, but in this act, he is praying for and looking forward to a restoration of all these things. So you see, the very putting on of this tallit is related historically and eschatologically to the Jewish hope. What a beautiful picture we see. The second thing is that it was to have a ribbon of blue. Now, there's two customs. Today, many will notice that the tallits that are worn by many Orthodox Jews today have a black ribbon rather than a blue ribbon. And sometimes you will see them wearing a tallit with black ribbons, and in the fringe itself, there is one blue thread. You see? Why are they wearing black today? What is black a symbol of? Mourning. Why are they mourning? They are mourning the destruction of the temple by the Romans in 70 A.D. And by wearing this black, they are lamenting until God will restore the tabernacle of Israel and the Beit HaMikdash, the temple of God, will again be used in Israel and be restored to them. And that will happen. So in this beautiful story here, we find, first of all, the tabernacle, and then the ribbon of blue reminds the Jewish people of what? Where is God? Who is God? He's not in a temple or a tabernacle or made with hands. No, no, no. The blue reminds the Jew that his God is the God of the heaven and the earth. "Heaven is my throne and the earth is my footstool," said the Lord. So the whole concept of the tallit and the blue ribbon reminds the Jew that his God is the God of heaven, the creator of the universe. The blue reminds the Jew of where God is. Next, we see there is a fringe on the border of the garment. The fringe are not tied down, but they're loose, they're free. And that's the symbol of the emancipation from Egypt, that they have... The fringe shows their freedom from slavery. But not only that, in being freed from their slavery, there are a lot of knots very specially tied. In each corner of the tallit, the tzitzit, the little fringe that comes down, with eight strands tied in a series of very closely calculated knots. In these knots, in the four corners of the garment, there are numerically 613 knots. These knots speak of the 613 commandments of the Jewish law. Not 10 commandments, 613 commandments of the Jewish law. So that when the children of Israel would look upon this tzitzit, look upon the fringe, it would remind them to that they might remember all the commandments of the Lord and do them, and that they seek not after their own heart and their own eyes, which, after which they used to go whoring. Here the tzitzit, the fringes, the 613 knots, reminds the Jew of the 613 commandments of the Jewish law. So these fringes in the corner of his garment are like pillars that protect him from sin. I shall never forget talking to a Jewish man one time who told how he went to the yeshiva, and he studied for about 3 years in the yeshiva, and he knew when he went to yeshiva he was not going to spend his life there, that he was going to be a businessman, but he wanted to know as much about the Jewish law as he could and to know more about his religion. So he went and spent 3 years in the yeshiva, and when he announced that he was leaving, the head of the yeshiva said to him, "Well, I cannot dictate your life, but it's difficult to understand how you would, after 3 years in the yeshiva, turn and go back into the market." And he explained to him, "Well, when I came, I intended to spend 3 years. This, I have accomplished what I came to do." And the old rabbi asked him, he said, "What have you learned?" He said, "Oh, I've learned so much. And I will never forget all that I have received in this yeshiva." And the old rabbi, in a very stern look, pointed his finger in the face of the student that was leaving and said, "Young man, I will tell you one thing. You have been laying to feeling the phylacteries. You have been wearing the tallit now for 3 years. I can tell you, you will never enjoy sin again." The man said, "You know," he was so right, "that I got something there that completely changed my life and my attitude." And he said, "I came out with a deep faith inside, and when I put on that tallit in the morning, I remember what that old rabbi said, I'll never be able to enjoy sin again." And these fringes that hang so loosely that I am free, I can do anything I want to do. But he says, "You know, there's something about those loose, dangling fringes that keep me tied to the God of Israel, that make me want not to sin and to dishonor his name." Isn't that a beautiful illustration? To the Jew, that in the tallit thou mayest remember all the commandments of the Lord thy God and do them. Now, as we go on to see the other developments of the tallit, we find that it not only had the fringes, but in the fringes you had the 613 knots, and the knots are tied with five large overhand knots down the fringe, and one of those eight tzitzit has to be cut precisely to the length to wound it a certain number of times between each knot. And when the man winds the tzitzit, now this does not always remain the same due to the shrinkage and so forth of the thread, but when he ties that, he goes around between the first and second knot, he goes around that 10 times with like a hangman's noose. One of those fringes is longer than the other, and he winds that 10 times between the first and second knot, and then he works it into the second knot. Then he brings that same string out, and he winds it 5 times around the threads. And then he ties the knot and ties that in between the second and the third knot. And then between the third and the fourth, he goes around 6 times, and he ties it in. And then between the last two knots, he goes around 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So that between each of these knots, there are 10 loops around the first, 5 between the second and the third, 6 between the third and the fourth, and 5 between the last two. So you have 10, 5, 6, 5 loops wound around as he was tying the tallit. Now what does this mean? The 10th letter of the Hebrew alphabet is the letter Yud. The 5th letter of the Hebrew alphabet is He. The 6th letter is Vav, and the 5th letter is He. So what he has tied in the windings, like a hangman's noose, around the tzitzit, is Yud, He, Vav, He, the unutterable name of God. Some people, oh, you mean Jehovah? Well, that's what they say it is, but it's really not, because there's not a J in the Hebrew alphabet. And if there's not a J in the Hebrew alphabet, God's name could not be Jehovah, could it? Yud He Vav He, the unpronounceable name. The Germans came along and they said Yahweh, Yahweh. Now, there is also no W in the Hebrew language. So how could God's name be Yahweh when there is not a J or a G sound, nor is there a W or a W sound in Hebrew? So Jehovah and Yahweh are not the name of God. The true name of God is unpronounceable. Only the 35, the Lamed He, the 35 righteous men of the Kabbalah know the true name of God on the earth at any one time. So we have the unutterable, unpronounceable name of God written. Now look, the blue reminds the Jew of where his God is. The 613 commandments remind the Jew of what his God is, the moral God, as opposed to the paganistic amoral gods. And the fringes remind him of his liberation, and the 613 commandments in the knots, and then the loops remind him of the name of his God, the unutterable name, Adonai Hashem, the unpronounceable name of God, is tied up in the fringes of the tallit. So we have the tallit and the tzitzit, and Israel was commanded to wear that throughout all their generations forever. Not just till Jesus came, but forever they were commanded to wear the tallit. Now, we see several occasions back in the years when I was in Israel, and the religious Ministry of Religious Affairs furnished a meeting place for the Institute of Judaic Christian Research, and we had, not only did they furnish the place, but Dr. Yonah Malachi sent out notices to all the rabbinic scholars in the area and the yeshiva that here is a Christian in Israel, Mr. Jones, that's doing something that's unusual, let's work with him. And you know, we had 40, sometimes to 60, and sometimes 70 people in those meetings who were Jewish scholars. It was not worship. We didn't have prayer. It was study. And we studied the tallit and tzitzit, all the references in the Old Testament. And then we divided the New Testament among about 30 of those participants, and they went in and looked for every reference in the New Testament that would have direct or indirect association with the tallit and the tzitzit. And did you know, to my dismay, we came up with 47 different allusions or references or absolute statements about the tallit in the New Testament. Many of them have been so lost and so misused. For example, it says Paul was a tent maker. Paul, what would they need with tents in Corinth, the marble city? There were no Bedouins there. What are they making tents in Corinth for? Paul was a rabbi. He sat at the feet of Gamaliel. And he worked with Aquila and Priscilla, who were making tallits, not army tents or Bedouin tents. They were making tallits. Tallits were used in Jewish worship, and Paul was a Jew and was a practicing Jew then. And he was skilled in the art of tying the tzitzit in the borders of the garment. We're going to see other passages, but that's just one to illustrate how the tallit was translated a tent when it was actually a pup tent, a tallit, a prayer shawl that was used by the Jews. And Paul, for 2.5 years, labored with Aquila and Priscilla, not supporting only himself, but all those that labored with him, through his craft of making the tzitzit for the tali in Jewish worship. We continue with this thought. Back in the Old Testament, we find that Elijah the prophet, Eliyahu Hanavi, is what he was called, and you can almost hear the thunder. But Elijah, it says, appeared, the Tishbite, and he was a hairy man, a gruff man, a man with a thundering voice, and he wore a camel hair mantle and a leather girdle. The leather girdle of Elijah was the priestly garment because he was a priest. And on this leather girdle were written the names of God, Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, in all different directions and structures, written in triangles where it could be read from every direction. Here, we find that Elijah comes with a leather girdle, a priestly girdle, like a tuxedo, a split tail, tied in the center with a leather strap. And over his shoulders, he wore a mantle, a talit of camel's hair, an eternal, something that would not decay or moths would not eat, something that had a lasting quality, a camel's hair mantle. And the tzitzit that went out from his garment bespoke the glory of this thundering prophet. We find that Elijah, one occasion, according to the Agudah, one of the rabbis in our study group, brought out that when Elijah went to the widow's house and she blamed Elijah for her son dying because if he had not come in, such a righteous man, her sin would not have been seen. But when the righteous Elijah came, God, it put his light in, illuminated her sin, and God had taken her son. And we find that in that story, in the book, Book of Kings, where Elijah went up to the house of the widow, and there in the widow's house, he took the child, went up on the housetop, and stretched the child out. And our Bible says that he stretched himself on the child. However, we find that, as the rabbi related, that it was not only that he stretched himself upon the child three times and cried unto the Lord, but that according to the tradition that he stretched his camel's hair mantle over the child, and that he bound the hands and the feet of the child with the tzitzit. And then Elijah stretched himself over the child, praying for God to raise the child. Can you see what Elijah is doing? It's like he's putting him into the tabernacle of the Lord of hosts, so that the living God, Shaddai, the El Chai, the living God, could give life to this child. And the first time he prayed, nothing happened. The second time he prayed, nothing happened. But the third time he prayed as a flaming fire. He shook heaven with his voice and demanded that God raise the child. And remember that James referred to this, in that the fervent prayer of a righteous man availeth much. Well, this is the story of Elijah and the widow's son. But he used this in order to raise, the widow's son was raised by doing this. Now, a very interesting thing, that when Elijah, at the end of the book of 1 Kings, in the 19th chapter, in verses 19, we find that as Elijah was coming from Horeb, that he passed by the field of Elisha, who was plowing with 12 yoke of oxen, and Elijah passed by him and cast his mantle upon him. In other words, Elijah comes by, he sees Elisha, and he cast his prayer shawl, his talit, over Elisha. Now, Elisha was a little squeaky voice prophet. The other sons of the prophets were always trying to mimic Elijah, but this was, as the Lord had said, the still small voice of Elisha would succeed the thundering voice of Elijah. not by the fire, not by the whirlwind, but the still small voice of Elisha would be the successor of Elijah. And then when we come into the book of 2 Kings, we find the story of how Elijah and Elisha went down from Gilgal, and they came from Bethel down to Gilgal, and from Gilgal they came to Jericho, and from Jericho they went on down to the Jordan River where it runs into the Dead Sea. And as they were on their way, and as they were pursuing, the prophets warned Elisha to get out of Elijah's way, because it says that Elisha was holding on to the garment of Elijah. And that the response of Elisha to those that warned him to get back, he said, "As the Lord liveth and as my soul liveth, I will not turn back, neither will I let thee go." So the two went on together. And then when they got to they got on near the Jordan River, even Elijah warned Elisha that he should stand back. But again he said, "As the Lord liveth and my soul liveth, I will not turn back, neither will I let thee go." They came down to the Jordan River, and Elijah took his mantle, his tallit, his prayer shawl. And in the 8th verse of the 2 Kings chapter 2, it says he wrapped it together. He took it in the corners and he wound it until it became like a stick in his hand, and he smote the Jordan River, splash! And the ripples kept going out, but they didn't return. And soon the Jordan River was parted, and Elijah and Elisha went across dry shod. But then when they got across and were up on Mount Nebo, it was here, on Mount Nebo, that Elijah, not Elijah, but Elisha, looked up, and there appeared a chariot of fire and horses of fire, and parted them both asunder. Elijah went up by the whirlwind into heaven. And Elijah saw it. He cried, my father, the chariot of Israel and the horsemen thereof. And he saw him no more, and he took hold of his clothes. He was still holding to the tzitzit. He was holding to his clothes, and he divided them. He put on the, it says rent them in two pieces. Actually, he divided them. He put on the leather girdle. He put on the camel hair mantle, and back down the river he comes. Can't you see that group of the sons of the prophets standing on the other side of the river? And here comes Elisha, that little squeaky voice prophet. None of them say he'll never make it. And I can just hear some of them say, "If they think we're going to follow his leadership, he's crazy. What audacity he has to take our master's garment." And little Elisha comes down, and he takes off the mantle. He takes it by the tzitzit, and he begins to wind the tallit of Elijah in his hand, as his master had just done. And when he smote the Jordan rivers, they parted hither and thither, and Elisha went over dry shod, and said, when the prophets saw him, they said, "We knew he would do it. We knew that you were God's appointed man all the time." You know, it's really amazing the difference in the attitude after he departed that water, as Elijah did and before. The thing I want to point out here, success always has its glamour. And these people, after, before he did this, nobody was going to follow this man's leadership. He's the little squeaky voice prophet. But once he divided the rivers of Jordan, everybody knew, and we were with you all the time. Isn't that true of human nature today? All you have to do to have friends is be successful. And if you want to find out how many friends you have, just be a failure one time. It's so beautiful, though, to see that when Elisha came across at seven times the spirit of Elijah was on Elisha. And he did many miracles with the tallit of his master. the camel hair mantle and the leather girdle. And then through his life and through that abundant miraculous ministry of Elisha, making the axe head float and all the miracles that he performed, and even had the power to call down UFOs. That's where fiery chariots back in those days, you know. After all those miracles that he performed, we find that he comes to the time that he will die. And in the 13th chapter of 2 Kings, it says that Elisha was fallen sick, and his sickness whereof he died. And Joash, the king of Israel, came down unto him and wept over his face and said, O my father, the chariot of Israel and the horsemen thereof. You see what King Joash is trying to do? He's trying to use the same words that Elisha used when he got the mantle, the camel hair mantle, and the leather girdle of Elijah. Now the king comes down and he mimics what Elisha has said. And Elijah said, take your bow and arrows. And he took the bow and arrows and he said, shoot, put the bow in your hand. And he did. And he said, shoot him out the window. You know how the story goes, that a prophecy that he would be victorious for the same number of times he shot the arrow out. But then we have to go to the Jewish sources now, apart from the Bible, to understand what happened. According to the Agudah, the story, when Elijah had died, no one was worthy or felt worthy to wear the tallit and the tzitzit of the master Elisha and Elijah. No one felt that God had spoken to them to wear it. They even tried to be democratic about it and elect whoever they might to succeed and to wear it in the stead of Elijah and Elisha. But when nobody seemed to be qualified to take the mantle of Elijah, they went to the priest, and they inquired of the ephod and the thummim who would wear it. So the high priest went into the sanctuary. He put on the thummim, the breastplate. He put on the ephod, and he stood before the menorah. Now, we must understand that the menorah, the seven golden candlesticks, were not the way we see them today. Later in the Solomonic temple, they were changed. But in the tabernacle, the branches went straight out horizontally from the main and bilaterally to the main shaft, the body of the menorah. There were three arms that went out. And on the ends of these arms, like in the position of the hands, there were being held up a combination of almond bowls, of almond knops and almond blossoms. An almond bowl, an almond knop, and an almond blossom. And again, an almond bowl, knop, and blossom. So that there were three almond knops. That is, the round almond while it's still, before it's taken out of the fiber case that it grows in. A round, large round ball of the almond was there, sitting in the bowl, the open bowl of an almond shell. And on top of the knop, the flower. And this was repeated. And on each of these knops, on each of these round balls of the golden menorah, was a Hebrew letter. You see, there were three on each side of each arm that went out from the shaft. And the Hebrew letters, Aleph, Beit, Gimel, appeared on the first three to the right of the high priest, or on the left side of the menorah. And then on the second bar that went across and held up the second set was three more Hebrew letters. And then on the third shaft, there was three more letters. And then the major body of the menorah, there stood four. So that all the Hebrew letters in the Hebrew alphabet, there were 22 knops and there were 22 Hebrew letters on the menorah. So that when the priest stood before the menorah and the light of the lamps that stood there, each lamp having seven wicks, 49 lights on the menorah, and the lights as they flickered, a strong beam of the candlelight would fix itself upon one of the knobs or upon one of the stones on the breastplate of the high priest. And it would be reflected very strongly into one of the letters on the menorah. And the Lord spoke to Israel by literally spelling out by the lights, the ephod and the thummim, spelling out on the menorah the message he had to them by illuminating the various letters on the knobs of the menorah itself. So we find many times in the Bible that they inquired of the ephod, and this is how God spoke to Israel out of the tabernacle of the Lord of hosts. So the priest took this garment into the sanctuary, and they inquired with the mantle, the camel hair mantle of Elijah and the leather girdle, they inquired whose would be worthy to wear it and whose it would be. And in that inquiry, the high priest said, the Lord told the high priest to leave it here. Now leave it here by the menorah. That is, leave it in the altar of incense until he whose it was and is shall come. Now it's very important to note that at this time, when the priest put the camel hair mantle and the leather girdle of Elijah in the altar of incense, because the Lord had promised, he whose it was and is shall come. This is the origin of the sitting of the cup of Eliyahu Hanavi on the Passover table. Every Jewish Passover, there is a cup sitting there that is filled during the service called the cup of Elijah. Because the Lord said, when he whose it was and is shall come, since that time they've expected the coming of Elijah. And it remained there in the altar of incense. What happened to it? Where did it go? What became of the mantle of Elijah, the camel's hair mantle, and the leather girdle? In tying this to the completion of our study, and to conclude the Old Testament, I'm going to make a bridge now. In the opening of the New Testament, one of the very first stories we are told is that Zechariah the priest was ministering in the temple of God at the altar of incense. This very altar where the talit and the tzitzit had been kept under that altar for all these years and centuries. And while he was ministering at that altar, the angel of the Lord appeared to him and said, Zechariah, you're going to have a son, and you will call his name John. This John was reared in the wilderness. And we understand that when John began his ministry some 30 years later, that John the Baptist came preaching between Shavuot and Yom Kippur. He came preaching repentance, because those were the days of repentance. And he was clothed in a camel's hair mantle and a leather girdle. Where did they come from? I think it's very well indicated in the text that all the region of Judea and Perea and Galilee came out to hear John, because they said that the prophet is come into the world. They expected that John the Baptist was the fulfillment of that promise, that he whose it was and is shall come. In the conclusion of the former side of this tape, we ended with John the Baptist having appeared in the wilderness in the camel hair mantle and the leather girdle of Elijah, as we see many years before. Now in this, the epitome of this basic study in the first type is to go back and to see the foundation and all of these things. Now we must understand that I have only touched, there are many references in the Psalms and in other places, but on a tape, we can only cover so much. In our study in Jerusalem, we spent 7 months studying the talit and the tzitzit. It's impossible in a short tape to begin to share that, But the idea of these tapes is to get you to study and to get you to look for these things. Now, what we want to do today is to see how in the book of Mark we see the illustration of the talit and the tzitzit as it was used by Jesus on a simple grammatic level and to simple ordinary people, a textual analysis of the words, and to see how that the talit and the tzitzit was used by Jesus. We find many times references in the New Testament where the multitudes came to Jesus that they might but touch the hem of his garment and be made whole. What does it mean, the hem of his garment? Are we talking about the cuff of his pants or the hem of his coat? No. We're talking about the talit, the Jewish prayer shawl that Jesus wore every day of his life. You say, well, the Bible does not say that. It does say that. When Jesus stood before those who opposed him and said, which of you can convince me of sin? What have I done in violation of the law? If he were not wearing a talit, that would have been an immediate response, because they were commanded to wear the talit and to look upon the tzitzit. It was a part of the normal dress of that day. So it was not only implied and inferred, but it's absolutely certain that Jesus wore the talit. And those that came to touch the hem of his garment were touching the tzitzit, the fringe of his garment. And in doing so, they were appealing to the very name of God and the very holiness of God for their healing. Now, the reason that we use the book of Mark for our study this morning is that we are dealing with the Mishnah of Mark as related to rabbinic hermeneutics. So, dealing on a simple grammatic interpretation to simple people by a simple writer, it is the nature hermeneutically to look at Mark for our illustration and to use the use of the talit, which we have gone back into the Torah, to the book of Numbers, and we have seen the basis for this. We have looked at the Haftorahs and seen how the prophets used it. We see sort of the bridge as John the Baptist used this, a bridge for our thoughts into the life of Jesus. And I'm not talking about between the Old and New Testaments. I'm talking about still under the Jewish canon, still under the Jewish economy, that John is bridging this in here, or Mark is bridging this in the sense of John the Baptist's ministry preceding that of Jesus. Now, in the fifth chapter of Mark, we find that Jesus has been to Gadara, and now he's back into Capernaum. And when he comes to the shore, there were many people that were waiting for him, and one especially, Jairus, who was the president of the synagogue, besought him that he would come because his daughter was at the point of death. And Jesus and all the people made haste up the street, and they were rushing to the house where this little 12-year-old girl was dying of a fever. But as they were going up that narrow street, and by the way, that street has been excavated today, and you can really see how narrow it is. But as this press of people was coming up the street, here in one of the houses was a woman. A woman who for 12 long years had had an issue of blood. Who, according to the Jewish law, was unclean, unclean, unclean. And because of her uncleanliness, we find that she was not permitted to sit where other people sit, or to lie down where other people lie down, or to be in company with other people, because she was ritually unclean. For 12 long years, her husband had not touched her, nor she her husband, or even the children, if they were over 12 years old, could not embrace their mother. She was ritually unclean. If you can imagine the agony of this poor woman, the depression that she must have been going through. Because in the Taharot, in the Mishnah, it says that a woman with an issue of blood is unclean. And there's a whole section there dealing with this woman's condition. It said that she couldn't even touch a piece of bread on the table. If she touched it, no one else could eat it. She could eat it, but no one else, because she's unclean anyway. But if she touch a piece of common bread, that bread is unclean because of her uncleanliness. So she couldn't even cook for the family. However, it said if she touched a piece of challah, that is the priest bread, that the bread was not unclean because the holiness of the bread was higher than her defilement. It also says in Taharot that if she touch a man or a priest, if she touch a priest's garment, the priest is defiled and unclean, but the garment is not unclean. The talit, the tzitzit, is not unclean because the holiness of the tzitzit and the talit is higher than her defilement. But the priest who occupies a holy office is defiled by her blood. He is unclean till even, and he has to wash his clothes, wash himself, and then come back into the camp. What do we see in this picture? We see this woman was in a derelict condition, because Mark pointed out that this woman, in her condition, in her frantic condition, in the book of Mark chapter 5 and verse 25, a certain woman which had an issue of blood, notice how Mark plays in that midrashic style of driving down a peg and then just going in a big circle around it. A woman which had an issue of blood for 12 years, she suffered many things of many physicians. She had spent all that she had and was nothing bettered but grew worse. You see how he goes around her condition? A very Mishnaic in its style. But here, when she heard that Jesus came, she came in the press behind him and touched his garment. Touched his what? Touched the tzitzit on his talit. Like the multitudes had done, she had heard, if you just touch the fringe of his garment, you'll be made whole. And this woman believed what she had heard, and she pursued, and she reached out, and she touched. One of the unusual situations in the New Testament. Because most of the time, we see Jesus stretching forth his hand and touching the sick. But here, the sick is reaching her hand forth to touch him. And she does not touch him, but she touches the fringe of his garment. And immediately, it says immediately, she was made whole. Straightway the fountain of her blood was dried up. She felt in her body that she was healed of the plague. And suddenly the uncleanliness and the curse that had been on her for 12 long years was gone. And she felt strong and clean inside. Jesus stopped dead in his steps when she touched him. He didn't move. Now remember, they're in a rush. They're going to the house of Jairus, and Jesus suddenly stops. He looks around. He says, "Who touched me?" His disciples are like, "What do you mean, who touched you? Look at the crowd. What do you mean, who touched you?" Jesus said, "Someone touched me. My virtue is gone out of me. I have been ritually defiled. I have no power to go on." Oh, how those words cut at the heart of Jairus, whose daughter was laying there dying. And Jesus' eyes searched around the multitude that stood there, and they were fastened upon a woman. And this woman came forth, and she fell at his feet. And she told the story. She touched him, and she was made whole. See this beautiful picture here. We have studied the ashes of the red heifer. And the ashes of the red heifer was the only offering in the Levitical system where a clean man took the water of the ashes, and the clean man sprinkled the unclean, and the unclean became clean, and the clean man who sprinkled them became unclean. So in the sprinkling of the water of the ashes of the red heifer, the clean man sprinkled the unclean became clean, and the clean man who sprinkled them became unclean. Imputation, the only illustration in the entire Jewish Levitical system.